Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, thanks for tuning in to Inside Scoop Live. I'm your host, Juanita Watson. And today on the program, I'll be talking with Tyler Titchler. He is here today to talk about his newest novel, Merrill Lives. Tyler is a seventh-generation resident of Marquette, Michigan. He has a Ph.D. in literature from Western Michigan University and a bachelor's and master's degrees from Northern Michigan University. He has lectured on writing and literature at Clemson University, the University of Wisconsin, and the University of London. Tyler is a regular guest host of Authors Access Internet Radio, the vice president of the Upper Peninsula Publishers and Authors Association, and he is the associate editor at Reader Views. He is also the owner of his own publishing company, Marquette Fiction. Tyler is the author of the regionally best-selling Marquette Trilogy, which is a family saga covering seven generations between 1849 in 1999, and centers on the pioneers who settled Upper Michigan. The trilogy consists of the novels Iron Pioneers, The Queen City, and Superior Heritage. Tyler lives in his native Marquette, where the roar of Lake Superior, mountains of snow, beautiful scenery, and sandstone architecture inspire his writing. Today, he has joined us to talk about his newest novel, Merrill Lives. I have him on the phone, and thank you so much for joining us today, Tyler.
Thank you, Juanita, and thank you for the great introduction.
Yes, yes. So congratulations. This is book four for you.
Yes.
Great. So tell us why you have decided to really focus your writing on regional fiction of Upper Michigan. Besides the obvious, I know you're from there, but what is it that draws you to regional fiction?
Well, yeah, there is the obvious, the write what you know aspect of it. I have tried writing about other areas or other types of fiction besides historical fiction, but I just really always felt this longing to write about the area and write about the people that live here. And really, I started out years ago with my grandpa telling me stories about his childhood and his parents and his grandparents and their experiences here. So that really all colored my desire to write about the area.
I understand that you actually, your love of history started way back in your teens, and that when you were 14 years old, you started collecting articles of historical interest from your local paper. I mean, that's how far back your interest goes in this.
Yeah, I did start collecting articles for years and never really quite knew why, other than I was interested in history. But then when I decided to start writing my novels about the area, I really felt that that was an advantage. I had all of these articles to draw from, so it was like all the research was already largely done for me, and I just had to go back and read through them and decide what to include in the books.
Mm-hmm. So tell us, just for listeners who aren't familiar with that area, tell us where exactly Marquette is and the Upper Peninsula, what that all encompasses.
Well, we're in the state of Michigan, and Michigan has two peninsulas, the upper and the lower. The Upper Peninsula is often mistaken as being part of Wisconsin, but we're actually our own section of Michigan. We also get confused with being called Northern Michigan sometimes, but Northern Michigan is actually the northern part of the Lower Peninsula. Marquette itself is on the shore of Lake Superior. We're the largest city in Upper Michigan. There's about probably between 20 and 30,000 people here in Marquette. We're a university town. We have Northern Michigan University. And the area was founded in 1849 because iron ore was discovered in the town of Negaunee, about 10 miles south of Marquette, in the 1840s. And what was envisioned is that they would use this iron ore to make steel and other different types of metal products. And because of this discovery, they thought that this was going to become a real boom town area.
Mm-hmm.
It was about the same time as the California Gold Rush. And the California Gold Rush gets a lot more attention, probably because it was gold and not iron ore. But
yeah.
Actually, Upper Michigan has produced far more mineral resources and in terms of dollar amounts that never came out of California, or I believe also the Alaska gold rushes.
That's amazing history there. So,
yeah.
I know that you actually have studied genealogy back, you know, you've retraced your family tree back to that founding time of Marquette. Is that
yes.
right?
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about your particular family lineage that traces the historical flow of what's happened in Marquette over the last 100 years, 150 years.
Well, my family goes back 7 generations, and the earliest generations, they did come here right after the discovery of the iron ore. They thought that they were going to be part of this this big metropolis that would, you know, rival Detroit and Chicago eventually. It never quite worked out that way, but that was their reason for coming. My four-greats-grandfather, Basil Bishop, he came here from New York, and he owned a forge out in New York, and was very interested in finding out about the iron here. He actually was in his 60s at that point, as was his wife, but he was so excited about it that he decided to pick up and completely relocate here, convinced 3 of his children also to come with him.
Mm-hmm.
His wife, we know very little about, other than that she had 18 children by him, which after that I can't imagine she had much energy left.
Can you believe that? Oh, my gosh.
But I don't know if she told him she was crazy or not. He was crazy or not, but she came here anyway. And he was going to build a forge when he got here. He didn't actually. There were some forges already being established, so he ended up working with Amos Harlow, who was the founder of Marquette, and had his own forge. And then he would write, we have some letters that Basil Bishop wrote back home to his children, trying to encourage them to move here, and just talking about what a wonderful climate it was, how the growing season was so wonderful, really kind of propaganda, because Marquette's known for its long, cold winters and short growing season. But that was where it all started.
So it basically, the town grew very quickly when it was founded, from what I understand.
It did grow pretty quickly. By 1860, there were 1,000 residents in Marquette. By the turn of the century, so there were probably 10,000. It didn't, you know, become an overnight success, but it did grow pretty fairly quickly, considering the, you know, the location and the, you know, what the population in the United States was back then.
What is the population of Marquette today?
It's probably in the mid 20,000.
Oh, okay. So it's not a huge city. It's still a smaller community.
Yeah, it is the largest city in Upper Michigan. To get to the next largest city would be Green Bay, Wisconsin, which is a good 3.5-hour drive.
Mm-hmm.
So it has remained pretty remote, which has its advantages and disadvantages.
You know, I find it so interesting that your family was, you know, kind of critical, one of the original pioneers of Marquette, and here so many years later, you're there, you love it, you're staying, and you're writing regional fiction in that area. I mean, that area must have very deep significance to you, and I would just like to know what living in Marquette and having that deep family history of the area really does mean to you.
I can't really imagine living anywhere else. I have lived other places. I lived in Kalamazoo, Michigan for 5 years. I lived in South Carolina for a year. And I'm sure that those places have their own history, of course, but there's this certain connection that I feel to this place that I wouldn't have that relationship anywhere else. And I think even if you don't have a long history of your family being in a place, if you live in a place for a long time, it's really just interesting to me how the place changes over time and what remains the same. You know, I can drive past buildings that my grandpa helped to build or my great-grandparents
mm-hmm.
helped to build, you know, 100 years ago, and they're still there. And
mm-hmm.
It just really helps you feel a connection. And plus, you feel this sort of timelessness about the place. You can remember a building that, you know, was on a corner 30, 40 years ago and isn't there anymore. But you know, it is still there in your mind and in your memory, and so you just kind of almost have this timelessness feeling
mm-hmm.
of connection to the area.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It makes me wonder how writing your regional fiction, which is also historical fiction, how that timelessness actually, how you bridge that in your work, in your writing. Do you know what I mean? Like how you weave that, the historical elements of the area that you're living in that are so obvious with modern day, and you bring it into your work with his, the historical fiction, but, you know, themes that are also timeless.
Right. I mean, you have your basic, you know, your basic love stories, which are going to be the same whether it's back in 1850 or 2000. I mean, people still fall in love. It's just the basic human stories of love and death and ambition. A lot of my Marquette trilogy is about the characters trying to decide, are they going to move here, are they going to stay here, are they going to leave here?
Mm.
And that's always been a difficult decision all through the area's history, especially now when, you know, the economy all across the United States isn't that great. There aren't a lot of jobs in Upper Michigan. It never did become the boom town that they thought it was going to be. Lots of people leave the area. I left the area for a while and decided to come back, and it just really, to some extent, it just really haunts you. It's not uncommon for people to leave here for several years and then come back.
So it's very, Marquette of today is very, very different than it was back in the day of your novels.
To some extent, the industries have changed. The logging industry isn't what it used to be. The mining industry, there used to be mines all over Upper Michigan. Now there's just a few left. There's still some of the major employers, but, you know, the area has to rely a lot more on tourism than it did before. Of course, the university's a big employer, which it wouldn't have been in the very early days.
Yeah, yeah. So your new novel, Narrow Lives, isn't a part of your Marquette trilogy, but there are some characters that overlap. So why don't you kind of give us an idea about your trilogy, the three books that make up your Marquette series, and then how your new book, Narrow Lives, is connected with it.
Okay. The Marquette trilogy starts out in 1849. It runs up to 1999, and it starts out with several different families coming to the area. And then as the books progress, those characters, their families intermarry, and eventually by the last novel, there's one main character who's descended from all of those early pioneer families. And the new novel, Narrow Lives, is kind of a offshoot of that. There's a character in the second book, The Queen City, whose name is Lysander Blackmore, and he has some relation with the Dalrymple and the Whitman families, who are part of the main family line through the novels. He's really just kind of a minor character in the book, but he's significant to some of the plots and how they develop. And I just really wanted to explore more about him because he's really a villain in that second book. And I wondered, you know, what was going on in his own personal life? What was his own family background? Why did he act the way that he did? Why did he make the decisions that he did? And why did he treat people the way that he did in that book? And there really wasn't a whole lot explained about his background. There were just little hints here and there. So I just really wanted to develop all of that on a much greater level by writing Narrow Lives.
Now, when you were writing The Queen City, did you know that there was a book about him in the future?
I did. I had ideas for it that I was kind of drafting on the side while I was writing my trilogy. I actually wrote the entire trilogy out as a rough draft, and then when I had it completed, the rough draft, I felt like I needed a break from it, so I went and I wrote Narrow Lives as sort of a vacation from the trilogy.
Oh, okay.
And also sort of just, you know, for my own entertainment and also hoping that it would become a book on the side. And then when I went back to working on the trilogy, Narrow Lives was pretty much drafted, but I still kept thinking about it and changing things here and there so they would match up with things in the trilogy. So they were kind of written simultaneously, really.
What was the strongest contrast with Narrow Lives compared to the other three books? Is it just that Narrow Lives is more character-driven, that you really get into the depth of that character, and you don't do that in your other books?
Well, I think the characters in the trilogy there are main characters who are detailed, but it does cover quite a large time frame, and so the books move very quickly. I also think the books are much lighter in tone. I mean, there are difficult situations in the books, but Narrow Lives is focusing on a character who really is kind of despicable and a villain, and so it is more character-driven in that sense. It's actually told as a collection of short stories, each one being told in first person by a different person who knows Lysander Blackmore. And he never actually gets his own section. All the characters are talking about him or are just relating their own experiences or their own lives, but his life has influenced all of their lives to some degree. Some of them have never even met him, but they have relationships with, like, his son, and so therefore he is still like an indirect influence upon them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a darker book too, I think, than my trilogy was.
Right. It's very, very different, and I think it was very wise not to include it in you know the series, to actually have it stand alone like that. I think it really says a lot by doing that as well. So what is the time frame of Narrow Lives?
Well, each of the stories takes place in a different time frame. It really starts out in 1915 and ends in the early 1960s, but it jumps around. I think the first chapter is 1924, then it jumps like 1929 and goes back to 1915.
Okay.
And just kind of moves around depending on who the character is and when the significant event happened in their life that is related to the rest of the plot.
Now, how did you come up with Lysander's character? Is this kind of based on someone that during your research, your historical research, was there anyone that kind of resembled this character? Where did he come from?
No, he is really pretty much completely fictional. He actually, Narrow Lives itself actually was a spinoff of another book that I wrote way back in the early 90s, I wrote this novel, which really became just the first two sections of Narrow Lives. And in that novel, there was a picnic scene, and one of the characters, just because I need a bunch of people at this picnic, one of the characters was Lysander Blackmore. And then later, when I was writing The Queen City, I realized I needed this character who would be a villain, and he needed to be a banker. And I thought, well, I had that banker that was at that picnic, so I'll use him.
Okay.
And it just kind of developed from there, and I started to think more and more about him. So there was no intention of creating a book for him originally, but he just kind of grew on me as time went by.
Yeah, that's so interesting. He really is a fascinating character. And the way that you've written this book from, you know, first person, other people's involvement with him, really, it's very, very creative. I'm interested in why no final chapter that is written by him kind of explaining himself. Why did you decide not to give his point of view?
Well, I think all the characters in the book, the primary character being his illegitimate son, Schofield Blackmore. Schofield is born just a couple years before his father dies, doesn't have any memories of his father, really, and just is kind of living with this shame that he feels of being part of that family. He was born in 1926, and of course things were much more restrictive back in those days. People were much more concerned about proprieties, and he is just trying to figure out, you know, why his father did the things that he did. Why would his father cheat on his wife to be with Schofield's mother? And why did, if Schofield ends up committing, or I'm sorry, Lysander ends up committing suicide, and all of the people in the city know that he committed suicide, but nobody really knows why, and they all have different ideas. And there is a clue to the reader in the book, but none of the characters themselves ever really figure it out. And they don't know if he finally felt shame over, you know, these cheating on his wife, or being afraid that somehow having these illegitimate children was going to affect him, or he actually commits suicide the morning after the stock market crash of 1929. So is it because he lost his fortune in the stock market crash? You know, nobody really knows.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to have a section about him because I didn't want him really to explain himself. It was more about all of those people and how his life influenced all of them and how they allowed that influence to affect their lives. And they have to make decisions about whether they're going to live with that shame or if they're going to try to push themselves beyond it and live their own lives rather than live a life that somehow is dictated by his influence.
Yeah, that is really, I love the way you went there in this book, and you really went deeply into the psyche of your characters. I mean, it's almost there's a real sort of psychological element to this novel. And I think that you're exploring some real core issues. There's some real big lessons for your characters to learn through their experiences with this person.
Yeah, and some of them I don't really think do learn anything, and others of them do, but it's just interesting that one person can have such an influence on people, and the influence can be so diverse with everybody, and really it speaks to how strong a person is, whether they decide to move past that or not.
So what were some of the lessons that you really wanted to spotlight with your characters?
Well, I think more than anything, just that the characters need to believe in themselves and not let what other people say about them or think about them stop them from doing what they want to do with their lives. And especially in Schofield's case, he does have some experiences when he's a child where he realizes that other people in the town look down on him because they know about his father and the past. But as he grows up, he holds that in him and thinks that everybody in town still is thinking about that and holding that against him. And he ends up working at the local grocery store. And pretty soon, as the years go by, he's not really trying to do anything with his life or have a better life than just working at the grocery store. And so pretty soon, he's like the oldest clerk there at the store, and this younger generation is growing up, and they don't know anything about his father or his parents or his past, and yet he still hangs on to it, even though times have changed, and, you know, the world is changing around him.
Mm-hmm. So it's so interesting.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Established in 1998, Rebecca's Reads is a book review and publicity service serving a large reading audience as well as a wide community of authors, publishers, publicists, and buyers and sellers. They offer reviews of recently published books as well as chapter readings, teasers, and videos to help you decide what book you would like to read next. Their insightful author interviews take connecting reader and author one step further, and if you decide you would like to purchase a book, an easy-to-navigate link will allow you to purchase the book immediately online. For the authors, publicists, and publishers, Rebecca's Reads has a variety of publicity services to help them market their book to their reading audience. Their services are budget-friendly and effective. For buyers and sellers, they have a monthly list of current reviews in the Book Review Index for easy browsing, as they know your time is precious and efficiency is a priority. Be sure to visit RebeccasReads.com and browse around their new space. Whatever your literary need, this user-friendly website may be just what you're looking for. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Just to remind you, I'm talking today with Tyler Titchler, author of Narrow Lives. You can find out more about Tyler through his website, MarquetteFiction.com. Would you say that Schofield was one of your favorite characters, or which character in these seven short stories particularly stood out for you?
I probably would say Lila. She has the shortest section, and she ends up being involved with Schofield later down the road. She's quite ornery, and I like that about her. She has a spark to her. I think she's quite humorous. I also, the last section I wrote, I thought the book was done, and then suddenly one day it dawned on me that I should let one of Schofield's legitimate children have a say. And so then I wrote the section about Matilda, and about her life, knowing that her father killed himself, and she's living in this house with her mother, who, you know, was just devastated by her husband's behavior, and yet knew about it and stayed married to him anyway, because that's what you did back in those days.
Right.
And she is just, Matilda is just very sheltered, and her brother and her mother get into this big argument, and the brother leaves the house and tells her, you need to get out of here too before mother destroys your life as well. And Matilda decides she needs to find a way to get out of the house as well, and so she ends up, I won't tell you what happened, but she makes some mistakes along the way, and she's not the brightest person. So I think she's quite comical as a result of just trying to figure out what to do and not really having anybody to go to guide her along the way.
You know, the time frame of these stories way back when, I mean, the times are so different now. It must have been really interesting to write in a time where society was very different, morals were different, values were different, and then on top of that, this is a small town where, you know, there's no secret. People know about your business, you know. I mean, that must have been very interesting as a writer to go there.
Yeah, what part of what it was that it was a small town that really interested me because everybody's lives interact with each other.
Mm-hmm.
In some way, everybody in the town had some connection to Schofield or to Lysander Blackmore. And the title of the book actually came from a quote from Willa Cather. I used a quote as the front quote for the book where she talks about small town life and how the phrase that I used was she says the escapes in the outside world are not so narrow, but in the small town you can walk down a street and at some point you have to walk past the man who cheated you, or you have to walk past that woman that you're madly in love with but she's married to somebody else and you can never say a word to her about it, and maybe, you know, in while you're walking down the street her skirt brushes against you or something and you just have to pretend like nothing happened. And so there is this internal drama in people. You know, there's maybe there's this person who's your enemy who lives on the other side of town, and you go to the grocery store, and there he is, and you just have to deal with it.
That's
not going to happen if you live in, you know, New York. You can go to a different grocery store on the other side of town if you want.
Right. Not a lot of anonymity in a small town.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So interesting. So, Tyler, what drives you to write?
I've always wanted to write. I guess that's the obvious answer. I think partly it's just that I've always been searching for something, trying to figure out what the meaning of life is and what the purpose is. And for a long time, I often wondered, since I would take, you know, creative writing classes or literature classes, and there was this part of me that always thought, well, maybe those aren't as important as taking chemistry, biology, calculus, you know, something that's more the sciences or math. But I really think that the most important thing that we're here on this planet to learn is how to get along with each other and our relationships with each other.
Mm.
And so I just really want to explore those relationships and how relationships are a way to learn. And I mean, sure, people have internal learning experiences, but I think really how we interact with each other is the best way that we learn. And I think, you know, writing novels is a really good way to teach people about relationships and make them think about their lives and the decisions that they make without, you know, actually lecturing to them in some way.
Was there anything on a personal level for you along that vein that you learned about yourself in writing this book that is quite different than your other writing?
Well, despite the time frame and being set back in the past and the restrictive society, it's really not even so much about the restrictions of society, but the restrictions that people put upon themselves.
Mm.
And I think we all do that. We all have these voices in our head that say, you can't do this. Or we have known people that have told us, well, you can't do this. And so those voices still play in our head even years after that person maybe is dead that said that initially. And it's really about overcoming your own fears. And I think that that's what the, you know, what the characters need to do. And we all have those kinds of fears. Before I published my books, I was always, you know, afraid to tell people that I even wrote books. People ask me what I like to do for fun, and I would just say, well, I watch TV, I read. You know, I would never admit to writing books on the side because I was always afraid of what people would say about them.
Isn't that interesting? And now you're a PhD in literature and you're writing books.
Right. I just had to overcome it. It was just one of those things that you know, you feel the fear and you do it anyway.
Yeah.
And it's been successful. Everybody has had very positive responses to the books.
I wonder if in a way this book for you was maybe a little bit of a cathartic experience as a writer, or maybe your catharsis happened before and that's what birthed this book and the deeper meaning of this book.
It's hard to say if it happened before. I think writing the book is experience. You're writing this book trying to talk yourself into doing it, trying to talk yourself into having the courage to do it. Even if you had the experience prior to that, as you're writing the book, you're really thinking about it and concentrating on, you know, it is the whole catharsis. In
So when you are writing, tell us a little bit about your writing process from the initial idea right until you have your edited copy. You know, what does that process look like for you, and how long do your books typically take?
Well, it's a very unorganized process. I mean, I may just have an idea and jot a note down on a sticky note or something, and then it'll just grow from there. I have collections of sticky notes in little Ziploc bags because I think they're all over my desk and I don't know what to do with them, and I try to write them all down on the computer, but you know, sometimes I just don't have the time, and sometimes I sit in a lazy boy with a notepad and I handwrite them out. Other times I do actually type them up on the computer and try to make sense of everything and organize it all. As far as keeping track of all my characters, the best thing I've done is I have a genealogy program on my computer, and I just made up a fake family tree for all the characters so I can keep track of their birth dates, their death dates, who they married, what their middle names are, what town they were born in,
That's a great idea. Mm-hmm.
And as far as how long does it take to write a book, I mean, this one, Nero Lives, I really started writing it back in 1992 when I wrote that other book that I ended up never seeing the light of day, but parts of it became parts of Nero Lives.
Mm-hmm.
So probably 12, 13, 14 years I worked on it on and off.
That's amazing. I know that you have a few more books that will be a part of this series as well. So have those books been basically kind of in the works for that long as well, or are those new pieces of the puzzle?
The next book I'm going to publish actually was the very first novel I started writing back in 1987.
Really?
It's been rewritten several times, and the main character ended up becoming a minor character in the trilogy. And then the book after that I actually wrote in probably about a 6 or 7 month period, and I haven't gone back and done extensive revisions to it at all, but one of the characters in that book actually was a character in a short story that I wrote way back when I was in middle school.
Oh, wow.
And she just kind of found a place in this book eventually and really is still not a main character in the book, but is significant to how the plot develops at the end of the book.
Mm-hmm. Do you foresee yourself in the future going into a completely different direction, getting out of the regional fiction and doing something that very much contrasts the work you're doing today?
I have lots of ideas for other novels that would be spin-offs of this series, but right now I'm more interested in writing something that's still historical fiction, but also maybe mixed some with fantasy, something maybe set in the Middle Ages and exploring history, but maybe on a more of a fantasy viewpoint. I've always been really interested in the King Arthur legend, so I'm thinking about something along those lines. All kind of being drafted out and may never become anything, but that's what I've turned to right now.
Oh, you have a lot of years ahead of you, so who knows where you could go when you're writing, really. You know, I'm wondering if writing regional fiction, you know, because that's what you're very much involved with, obviously, right now, If you have to keep anything in mind, anything in particular, in the writing process and writing a story that needs to really breathe a certain time and setting, if there's anything that you really have to keep in mind that to make this effective for the reader, to really put them in that place. And that probably applies to historical fiction as well, so you know, if you can talk to those two genres.
Sure. I think you really need to be detail-oriented. I have not had many people point out errors in my books because I spent lots of time researching the details, and that can be details about, you know, where a certain road is and which way it turns and what river is along it to, you know, the historical details about an area when a house burnt down or when a hotel was actually open for business. And then the other thing, especially with regional fiction, is you really want to focus on that region almost as if it's a protagonist in the book, or aspects of it. For example, Lake Superior, there's a scene in my first book where one of the characters is looking out at Lake Superior and just realizing that Lake Superior is a huge influence on her life. It's almost like a family member. And she has a sister who drowned in the lake.
Mm.
And at the same point, the water that she drinks comes out of that lake. It gives life to her, and yet it took life from her family. It's almost like the lake is a family member that you have a,
wow,
you know, this love-hate relationship
mm-hmm.
with. And other things about the area as well, the winters. The snow is beautiful, but when you get to March and the snowbanks are 6 feet high here and it snows again and you just are sick of shoveling it, you ask yourself, why do I live here?
Mm-hmm.
So it's this relationship that you have with the land, with the climate, with the, you know, the different landmarks in the area, and all of those things. I think you really have to focus on as if they were almost living beings, or you know, more than just a lake or a snowfall.
Do you ever, in writing regional fiction, do you ever have to consider how you can write your story in a way that it will bridge a wider geographic audience, you know, that it will be appealing to people that, you know, maybe live in a different part of the country or really even a different part of the world?
Absolutely. I mean, you want to make it as interesting as possible. And I think lots of people, they don't know what winter is like. They live in Florida. They live in Texas. They live in California, and they just don't really have that kind of a understanding of how dramatic winter can be.
Mm-hmm.
And so you want to make the book exciting in that way. You want to have scenes that are, you know, blizzards that the characters have to struggle through. And at the same time, you want to have universal things that people can relate to. You know, like I said before, you have your stories about romance. You have characters who have to make certain decisions about their lives that are not necessarily different than decisions that somebody living in another area would have to make. But in terms of it being regional fiction, the region itself has to, in some way, influence that decision also.
Mm-hmm. Now, are the books that you are interested in reading and have been reading, is that in the regional or historical fiction vein? Is that your preference?
Oh, I love to read everything. You name
Do
it.
Do you?
It. I really was influenced a lot by people like Willa Cather, who was one of the foremost writers of regional fiction in her day. And Helen Hoovitt Stantmeyer wrote a wonderful novel called And Ladies of the Club, which was a big hit back in the mid-80s. It was a historical novel, and that one influenced a lot. So. But I probably more than anything, I was influenced by the British classics. My PhD in literature is in 19th century British literature, and I was just very interested in studying the development of the novel and people like Anthony Trollope and Charles Dickens and the Bronte sisters, you know, all had big influences on me.
Isn't that interesting? So how do we see that influence show up in your writing?
Well, I think Anthony Trollope, for example, he wrote two series of books, the Palliser novels and then the novels that are focusing on the area of Barchester. And he really does a lot of what I do, the characters interlapping from one book to the other. Maybe a main character in one book is a minor character in another book. So a lot of that, I've had lots of people compare my books to James Michener, which I can understand where they're coming from. I'm not a big fan of James Michener, but you know, it's sort of the same thing where he picks an area. His books are titled Alaska or Hawaii. You know, he picks an area and he focuses on and tells the history of the area.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you ever read, I imagine it would have to be a different genre, where you just basically are in the role of a reader and dive yourself into the story so you're not, you know, reading it as a writer would read it and I don't want to necessarily say critiquing it, but taking ideas out of it. Do you know what I mean? Like, do you ever just lose yourself in a book?
Sure. Especially mystery novels and suspense and thrillers. I tried unsuccessfully to write a mystery novel, I just am completely in awe of mystery writers. I don't think I could ever possibly write a plot that would be convincing anybody to think there was any mystery going on or how to keep people guessing at what was going on. And I can easily sink into those and just read them till the end and not think about how the book is put together because it just seems too complicated to me.
Right. So, very interesting. Well, it's been really great talking with you, Tyler. You know, I actually have one more thing that I hope that you can talk a little bit to today. You know, you have published 4 books now. You're very much involved in the publishing world. You have your own publishing company. What advice at this point would you give authors that are just starting out with that dream of writing their own book and maybe are in that fear spot that you were talking about a little earlier, or seeing more of the challenges ahead as opposed to the possibility?
Well, I would say, first of all, just never give up. I mean, just believe that you have a story to tell, and you're the best person out there to tell that story. And if you're writing nonfiction, same thing. You have experiences to give the world, and you're the best person to write about that, the best person to write about that topic because of your personal experiences. And we hear all the time about how there's 200,000 books published every year and how bad the competition is, but there is an audience out there for everybody. You know, even if it's a small audience, there are people out there that are going to want to read your book and that are going to be interested in your book. And then just do your research. If you don't have your book published yet, I would suggest you join like a local organization. I'm the vice president of the Upper Peninsula Publishing Authors Association, for example. There's probably local organizations in different cities or different states, and they can really give you a lot of advice about the best way to publish your book. And it really depends on what your goals are with your book, whether you want to try to find a traditional publisher and collect rejection letters until you do, or if you want to self-publish the book and who your audience is and how many copies you think you want to print. All of those are going to vary from person to person. So there's not any really right way or wrong way, but if you get involved with a group of other people who have experience or are following the same quest that you are, you'll get a lot of advice and find out a lot of the do's and don'ts of the publishing world.
Yeah, that's great advice right there. Now, how much focus do you put on marketing and promotions? Like, are you doing a lot of book signings and promotional type of endeavors in the area?
I do. I go to lots of book signings, and I also go to lots of different events like craft fairs, Christmas craft shows. There are sometimes they're not any great sales there, but sometimes you'll sell a lot. It just really depends, especially in the Christmas season.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can market a lot of books that way. And you never know what's going to happen with an event. I went to a book signing in one of the nearby towns here, and I only had two people show up. And, you know, I would have thought that that was a failure. Some people might think that that is a failure, but one of the people that showed up was the local librarian, and now she wants to have the library there read my book as their book of the month for the local book club.
Wow.
And then she wants me to give a city tour of Marquette to everybody about the places that are mentioned in my book. So we're looking at probably close to 24 people who are going to have this dinner and this tour, and
yeah,
that's exciting for me. I love to tell people about Marquette. So you never know what an event could turn into.
Yeah, that is really a fantastic story. I mean, that really speaks to perseverance and just really getting out there. I love that, and congratulations. That's very exciting. Yeah, you will be the town historian.
Well, I aspire to it. There's a couple other town historians, but maybe in the future, yes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So your website, Tyler, is MarquetteFiction.com, and your books can be purchased through your website?
Yes.
Okay, wonderful. And listeners can contact you, find out more information about you. What else is up on your website?
Well, there's a timeline of Marquette's history, which people might find interesting. They can go there and see what all the different main events of the history of the area are and events that are mentioned in the books. There's also a list of all the characters and their family trees because they can be kind of complicated. I would just advise people to read the book first, or at least be reading the book when they look at them so it doesn't give away the plots of who marries who.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's some articles I've written about the Marquette area and how it's affected my writing, how it's influenced my writing, and just different aspects of different places mentioned in the books that I've written about the history of.
Great. Wonderful. Well, Tyler, thank you so much for coming on the program today. It's been great talking with you. We definitely, for me anyway, I've learned a lot about an area that really I knew nothing about. So, you know, this has been really fantastic. Much success to you with Narrow Lives and your trilogy, your Marquette trilogy, really. We wish you all the success.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure. I really enjoyed talking to you today, Juanita.
Yeah, great. All right, Tyler, well, you take care. I hope to talk with you again soon.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Okay, listeners, there we go. I've been talking with Tyler Titchler. His new book, Narrow Lives, and his three previous books in the Marquette Trilogy can all be purchased through his website, MarquetteFiction.com, as well as through online booksellers. And I believe it can be ordered locally as well, so you can check your local bookstores if they don't have it on their shelf. So I hope you've very much enjoyed the interview today. I certainly have learned a lot, and thank you so much for listening to the program Inside Scoop Live once again. I'm Juanita Watson, and until next time.